And we are back. Good afternoon. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Chartok on Vox Pop this afternoon. It's Medical Mondays, and joining us is to discuss cardiac surgery and associated conditions is Dr. Lewis Britton, the head of cardiac surgery at Albany Medical Center. Dr. Britton specializes in a full range of cardiovascular and cardiothoracic surgeries, including aortic surgery, complex coronary surgery, and minimally invasive valve surgery. Dr. Britton's a graduate of Georgetown University in Washington. He completed his fellowship in cardiothoracic surgery at Boston Children's Hospital and is board certified in thoracic surgery. Dr. Britton, welcome to Vox Pop.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
If you'd like to get in and ask Dr. Britton a question, and these are some serious subjects and some great questions, come on and get them in. The number is 800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. And before we take any calls, I want to ask you a few questions. We were speaking off the air about some of the newer things in your field, and I guess one of the most exciting is the amount of minimally invasive surgery that can be done now.
Sure. Yeah, we're now able to do, not in all cases, but in many patients with valvular diseases, aortic valvular disease, whether they be valves that are obstructed or is in aortic stenosis or valves that leak as in aortic insufficiency, and patients with mitral valvular disease, whether it be from degenerative diseases, getting older and whatnot, some patients with things that they were born with, and other patients who've acquired things because of rheumatic fever and that type of problem, that we can now either replace or fix these valves through smaller incisions, normally on the side of the chest, as opposed to having to go through the traditional fashion, through what we call a median sternotomy, which is the incision down the center of the chest, which requires opening the breastbone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of these procedures are still open heart operations, and they therefore require the use of a heart-lung machine to take over the functions of those two organs while we are inside the heart and working on it. The recovery period can be somewhat shortened because of this. People are able to go back to more vigorous activity and whatnot a little earlier because they don't have to wait for the breastbone to heal, which, like any other broken bone, takes about 6 weeks.
Sure.
Before you can put a load on it. And so this has allowed us to, as I say, particularly in younger patients and whatnot, get them back to work more quickly, and even in older folks to be able to get them back to more, you know, to more normal activity in a more rapid fashion.
Now, speaking of heart surgeries, one of the more common surgeries we hear about is the bypass surgery. Is that getting more and more routine, or is it still something that people have to, you know, really? I mean, you have to worry about any kind of procedure, but is it becoming, you know, second nature to some surgeons?
Well, the truth is that coronary bypass surgery for the majority of patients really is a relatively low-risk operation. If you look at, you know, New York State keeps very close tabs on all the data and all the statistics in terms of open heart surgery in New York State, and there are databases that are kept by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, which are international in nature. And if you look at the mortality rates for coronary bypass surgery, and this is all comers, this is people who come into the hospital, you know, on their last legs, as well as people that are having relatively elective surgery, and the mortality rate is under 5%.
Mm.
And it's, to kind of give you a comparison, if you look at gallbladder surgery, for example, that carries a mortality risk all comers somewhere in the 2-3% range. So the majority of the patients that we operate on, the risk of having coronary bypass surgery would be less than the risk of having a gallbladder removed.
That's something. That's come so far and so long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's pretty routine until they say you need it, and then, uh-oh. Exactly.
Well, as I often tell patients, you know, I said this is easy for us because we do it every day, all day,
mm-hmm.
and this is hopefully something you're going to only have once, although that's not always the case. There are people that have to come back and have a second intervention, but we do really try to do the operation that will take people through the rest of their lives, hopefully.
Okay, if you have any questions for Dr. Britton, get them in now. Our number is 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. Let's go to the phones now and take our first call. It's Bill from Greenfield. Bill, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I had a question for the doctor regarding statin drugs. Position on the benefits of them.
Okay, we're kind of losing you, Bill, so speak up, please. I think your cell's going away.
Sure. My question for the doctor is regarding statin drugs, his position on statin drugs and their benefit long-term, and also if there's a direct correlation between cholesterol levels and coronary disease.
Well, that's a very good, interesting, and quite complex question that I'm not going to be able to completely answer for you. To get to the first part of it, I believe statin drugs are have been a very big advance in the treatment of coronary artery disease. We certainly have seen a decrease in the number of people requiring coronary bypass surgery over the years. Now, part of that has been because of interventional cardiologic techniques, stents and angioplasty and whatnot, but also the number of patients coming back after having interventions or after having coronary artery disease has decreased as well. And I think a big part of this has been the use of statin drugs. Unfortunately, not everyone can take them. There are people that have sensitivities to them, although there are multiple different types of statin drugs that can be used, and it's rare that someone is allergic or sensitive to all of them.
The other part,
you asked about cholesterol and its direct correlation to coronary artery disease and whatnot, and it is certainly a very strong factor in the development of coronary artery disease, and we've learned a lot more about cholesterol over the years. We used to just worry about the absolute number. You know, everybody said if it was over 200 or 250, that was a big problem. We have learned, however, that there are good and bad cholesterols. The so-called high-density lipoproteins and low-density lipoproteins, the high-density being the ones that you'd rather have. And there are many different ways to manipulate those as well, some of it being diet. The statin drugs do this as well, exercise, those type of things. Unfortunately, a very strong indicator and predictor of coronary disease is also genetics, and that's something that we, at least as yet, have not figured out how to control.
Okay, Bill, thanks for your question. 1-800-348-2551, that's the number to call. Let's go to Frank in Ballston Spa. Frank, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Doctor, I have a question. This spring in April, I had a CAT scan for something else, and it was discovered I had a 4-centimeter aortic aneurysm on the ascending aorta. And then, about a month ago, I had a PET scan and a CAT scan, and the aneurysm was 4.1 and 4.4. I don't know why I got two different values, but I did. I guess my question is, I'm seeing a cardiothoracic surgeon on this for follow-up, but what are the restrictions on my activity? The surgeon told me I shouldn't be lifting weights or probably running and you know, any strenuous thing. So what are the restrictions on my activity, and what would be the nature of the surgery that I would have to have if it gets to the point where I have to have it corrected?
Well, Frank, this is a very common problem that we're seeing more and more today because of people having CAT scans, CT scans, PET scans, et cetera, for other reasons. Yeah. And we're seeing a large number of patients. I follow several hundred patients with a scenario much as you're describing, where they were found to have an ascending aorta that was in the 4 to 5 centimeter range. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they get sent to us to evaluate. I will tell you at the start that worrying about surgery, we normally don't really give serious consideration to that in patients who don't have a congenital syndrome such as Marfan's or something of that nature, something that they're born with that has a weakening of the arteries as part of its makeup.
Okay.
until they get over at 5.5 or over sonometers, because until they get to that size, there really isn't any significant increase in risk of the arteries either tearing or rupturing, which is what we really are concerned about and why one would consider doing an operation for something like this. As far as restrictions are concerned, I tell the majority of my patients that, I mean, first of all, if you can tolerate them, even though there's no real strong scientific evidence, there's a lot of data that would suggest that beta blockers are a good thing to take. These slow down your heart rate and slow and decrease the force with which your heart contracts, and therefore decreases the amount of stretching that occurs in the aorta with every heartbeat that we all have.
I am taking that.
Yeah. The other thing is that as far as activities are concerned, I don't think that aerobic activity is a problem. As most physicians will tell you and most exercise physiologists, you should exercise, but only to the point where you can still carry on a conversation. You know, you shouldn't be going to where you just you're gasping for breath and couldn't, you know, get a word out type of a thing.
Right. I understand. Yeah.
And then isometric type exercise. And those are, you know, things like weightlifting and that type of stuff. You should avoid any heavy isometric exercise. And I usually base that a little bit on patient size and, you know, but usually somewhere between 50 and 100 pounds is the limit that I like to put on that.
Okay.
And then, as you've said, you've been seen by a cardiothoracic surgeon. You should have follow-up on a periodic basis. And that's somewhat dependent on, you know, what the size is and whether it's changing. In terms of getting one study that says 4 and one that says 4.1 or 4.2, you know, a millimeter, which is what they're talking about, a tenth of a centimeter here, is a very small amount and really is within the error of the test. So it's really more of a trend thing. And I wouldn't be real concerned if, you know, one test says 4 and the next one says 4.2, you may well find that the next one will be back down to 4 again. And there are a couple of different ways that it should be followed. You should have the CT scans as well as echocardiograms periodically because they look at different parts of the aorta.
All right.
And then lastly, you asked about, well, what would happen if this gets to the point where it needs to be operated upon?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's a very broad spectrum of operations that could occur, from having to replace a very small segment to having to replace a good, you know, the majority of your aorta in your chest. And can include having to deal with the valve and whatnot. And so it's a little difficult to get into that. And there are new techniques being developed to deal with some of that as well, depending on where the aneurysm is. We do have some techniques now that allow us to do some of it with catheters and by putting stents inside the aorta.
All right.
Frank, that's all you need to know right there.
That's good. Very good.
Thanks for your call.
For the information.
1-800-348-2551. We're just getting started. We'll be back with more of your questions right after this.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Peter's Health Partners, nearly 12,000 professionals offering a comprehensive healthcare system in the greater Capital Region. Edward Jones, Uptown Kingston. Risa Condi, Edward Jones Financial Advisor, Making Sense of Investing, 845-331-6293. SPAC, presenting Saratoga Wine and Food and Fall Ferrari Festival, featuring wine tasting, cooking, seminars, and more, September 7th through 9th, SPAC.org. Smith College Museum of Art, hosting monthly second Fridays from 4 to 8 p.m., hands-on art making for families at 4, and an open eyes gallery walk at 6, smith.edu/artmuseum. In New York Farm Bureau, local farms, local food, offering membership benefits at more than 150 farm stands and farm wineries across New York State, protecting farms since 1911, nyfb.org.
And when we are back on Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-34-TALK-1. I'm Bob Barrett, in for Alan Shar, Talk on Medical Monday, and our guest today is Dr. Lewis Britton, the head of cardiac surgery at Albany Medical Center. We're taking your calls on, well, heart disease and anything right around that area. Heart and lung, 1-800-348-2551. We have some more calls up, so let's get right back to your questions. We'll go to Michelle in Albany. Michelle, good afternoon.
Oh, hello, doctor.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could speak to the pros and cons of tissue versus mechanical valve replacement, particularly in a 40-year-old patient. If they went with a tissue, what's the likelihood of having a replacement surgery again versus blood thinners and
sure.
the mechanical one?
Sure. This is a very common question and something that we don't have an absolute right or wrong answer to. The difference between the two valves, what you're talking about, tissue valves or what we call bioprostheses, which are valves that are made out of either pig's valve tissue or actually the sac that surrounds the heart in a cow, that's been specially treated so you don't react to it or reject it, if you will. These valves have an advantage in that they do not require blood thinners. Now, there's a little bit of about that, where in the mitral position, these valves, if you have an irregular heart rhythm and whatnot, even with a tissue valve, you may have to be on blood thinners, Coumadin being the most common one. However, if you have a problem with bleeding and whatnot, they can be stopped. The disadvantage of the bioprosthetic valves are that they wear out. Now, in the aortic valve position, these valves are probably somewhere between 15 and 20 years in their current state. The mitral valves are a little less durable, probably somewhere closer to 7 to 10 years. So that obviously you're talking about someone in their 40s, there is a reasonably high likelihood that at some point in time in their lifetime they're going to require a reoperation. Now, I will say that assuming that no other problems crop up during that period, the risk of reoperation is not really much greater than the risk of a first-time operation, although obviously you'll be older, so there's a little bit of an increased risk based on that. And it means that you go through the risk twice. The mechanical valves, these are valves that are made out of carbon or graphite and plastic, have the advantage of, at least in human terms, in either position, lasting forever. Their big downside is that you must be on blood thinners for the rest of your life, and it's not something that you can, well, maybe I won't take them for a couple of 3 months, that type of a thing, because if the blood thinners are not at the proper level, then you have problems with the valves can clot. Either clots form on the valve and be sent elsewhere to causing strokes or problems with kidneys and legs and whatnot, or they can actually make the valve stop working properly and in a catastrophic sense make the valve stop opening at all, at which point obviously the outcome is almost uniformly fatal. The problem with blood thinners is, like any other medication, they have their side effects and difficulties. You have to keep them at the right level. Too much blood thinner and there's a problem. You can have problems with bleeding. Not enough blood thinner, you have problems with clots forming. So there's a trade-off. You know, for someone in a young age group who is perhaps not involved in contact sports and those type of things, who is reliable and doesn't mind taking a medication and being a little careful about banging and cutting themselves, I think the mechanical valve is the proper choice. The bioprosthesis, certainly, for someone who doesn't, you know, wants to be very, very active, doesn't want to take blood thinners or is concerned about that, there's certainly not wrong to say that a bioprosthesis, as long as you understand, there's a chance something else is going to have to be done down the line.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your question, Michelle. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Troy and talk to Adrian. Adrian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I think, Dr. Bennett, you were on the team that operated on me on June 18th at Albany Med. I had a valve replacement.
It is possible. I'm Dr. Britton, but Dr. Bennett is also a member of our team. It could have been either one of us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Anyway, I was going to thank you.
Well, you're more than welcome.
my question had to do with something you may have already answered. Someone asked me what kind of replacement I had. Was it bovine or porcine? And I didn't know. And I didn't know what difference it made.
It really doesn't make a great deal of difference. The porcine valves are actually valvular tissue, and it's a little bit like the difference between a Ford and a Chevrolet. There are a little difference in appearance. Their function really is about the same, and it has a little bit to do with the size and how things are inside your aorta, as to which type fits best. And that's usually how we make that determination. As far as aortic valves are concerned, we use far more bovine valves or cow's tissue valves, and for mitral valves, we use far more porcine or pig's tissue valves.
I don't even know which it was.
Is it working?
Yeah.
Well, the question
has to do, you said that there was a time lapse possible where you might have to repeat it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm 83. So I'm hoping it's going to last me.
I would think at 83, assuming that this is an aortic valve, which is the most common, that you should do very well with that. And I think the likelihood of the valve not outlasting you is probably less than 1%.
That's very reassuring. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for your call. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to Glens Falls and talk to Karen. Karen, good afternoon.
Hi, my name's Corinne, and
I was really close.
Oh, yeah, I know, that's okay, I'm often mispronounced. I had a thoracic outlet decompression done at Albany Med in 09, and they had told me there was some atypical anatomy, and that normally you'd have to have both sides done because normally that's symmetrical. I went to see him because I started to have the same symptoms on the right-hand side, so I went to see him. And they had originally told me that at least we know that it worked and you had gotten 100% recovery, so we can just go ahead and do the other side. But when I got there, he said, well, now we have a new protocol. You have to get this, you have to see this other doctor and get this injection first. And I was just wondering what that was about.
Corinne, although this is obviously in the arena of thoracic surgery, and I was originally trained in that, this is not something that we do a great deal as thoracic surgeons.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty rare.
Yeah, and so it's rare, but in some centers the thoracic surgical service does take care of this. That really is not the case in this area. In fact, the majority of these are done by the vascular surgeons. The problem with thoracic outlet syndrome is there are a multitude of causes for it, and I'm certain that and we are learning all the time how to better differentiate the patients that are going to do well with operations or patients that would do well better with exercise routines and those type of things. And I'm certain.
Well, they did try that first. I did do quite a bit of PT beforehand, so we could rule out, less invasive ways.
Right,
and I'm
certain that the tests, and I must say I'm not familiar with what you're talking about in terms of the tests that they're talking about doing, but I'm certain that this is something to better refine your treatment so that they can be as certain as we are ever can be that the ultimate treatment will get you the most benefit with the least risk. But I would have to say that I would refer you back to your surgeon and your primary care to talk to them more about that.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. 1-800-348-2551 is the number to call. The calls keep coming. Let's keep going. We have Steve in Stone Ridge. Steve, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a 69-year-old male. And I think my age is significant, not only absolutely, but also because when I was young, a breakfast of steak and eggs was considered very healthful. And then cholesterol was discovered and it was considered desirable to get it under 300. And all my life, blood lipid testing has advanced. My blood lipids have always made physicians unhappy. About 30 years ago, I developed an inverted T wave, and as a result of that, I've had several nuclear stress tests, and approximately 1990, I had a cardiac cath The nuclear stress tests have always shown good perfusion. The stress test showed one luminal irregularity with everything else completely clear. And I just can't figure out why I'm on the spectrum for crustis that physicians and cardiologists are concerned about my blood lipids, because the lipids are in my blood not doing any harm. So maybe you help with...
Can you shed some light on that, doctor?
Well, a little bit of that broke up. Now, you said you had a cardiac catheterization now about 20 years ago. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what did that show?
One vessel had a luminal irregularity. The other vessels were completely clear.
Okay. And you've had stress tests since that time?
Several, yes.
Okay.
Before and after.
And those have shown no problems?
No problems.
Well, if you were listening earlier, we were talking a bit about statins and lipid levels and the risk factors for the development of coronary artery disease. And I would suggest, and it's likely that there are not a lot of people, particularly males in your family, who have had a lot of problems with heart disease or heart attacks or early death and that type of thing.
Not a lot,
yeah,
correct.
I think you're probably one of those very fortunate individuals who, for whatever reason, genetically, and perhaps for some of the other factors that we know contribute to coronary artery disease, you've been spared that. That, however, does not mean that you shouldn't be concerned about these things. And as you grow older, if we live long enough, are fortunate to live long enough, essentially all of us will develop some level of hardening of the arteries or atherosclerotic cardiac disease, whether it's in the coronary arteries or in the arteries that feed blood to your brain, or whether it be in the arteries that go to your leg and whatnot. These things, you know, do develop to a certain extent. Now, whether they develop far enough that they become a problem for you is one of the things why we try to control these risk factors, and cholesterol being one of them. And as we talked about earlier, you know, there are many different types of cholesterol, and without knowing exactly how yours breaks down and whatnot, there are many people that have very high cholesterol levels, but the majority of their cholesterol is the quotes good cholesterol, and therefore they're not, they're almost protected by having a higher level. And, you know, certainly if you haven't been a smoker, if high blood pressure hasn't been a problem, you're not diabetic, there's not a strong family history, you manage stress better than some of us, all of those things are helpful in preventing the onset of coronary artery disease. And so I would say to you that, bravo for having come this far and doing this well, but I wouldn't give up on continuing to watch all of those things. And I think your physicians are very, very correct in continuing to want to keep a close eye on those things. And as I say, we're also learning more and more about lipid metabolism and what, you know, what the different levels of cholesterol mean and how to better control them.
Okay.
Well, the only really stage.
Okay, Steve, I think we're losing you. 1-800-348-2551. The phone just kind of died on him there. Let's go to, we'll take one more call here. I believe that's Goldie. Goldie in Eckerd, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, this is me. And I actually wanted to talk to the doctor about statins.
Well, go right ahead.
I had been taking statins for quite a period of time, and I was really, a period of time meaning about 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm right now 65. And I do have a pretty good family history of my older relatives, both men and women, having heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
But the statins have been causing me grief. They've been giving me muscular symptoms, and they've also been giving me memory loss symptoms. And I recently stopped taking them, and of course these side effects have dissipated. And I was wondering, how often would a wise plan to monitor my cholesterol be?
Well, it's a little hard to answer exactly. I mean, I think what you're asking is how often should your blood work be checked and whatnot? Certainly at least annually and perhaps more frequent than that. But to go back a little bit to where you say the statins had been causing you problems, and certainly the muscle aches and that type of thing are very common side effects. Well, I shouldn't say they're not common. Of the side effects that occur with statins, these are some of the most common ones, although the vast majority of patients do not have problems with them. The memory loss is a little bit more unusual, but clearly if it's gotten better since you've stopped taking them, I think one has to at least consider that as a cause and effect relationship. But there are many types of statins, and I would suggest to you that you should speak to your primary care doctor or your cardiologist and talk to he or she about those the other types. There are other types that can be tried, particularly given your history and without knowing what your cholesterol levels are, and again, you know, how they spread out in terms of the different types of cholesterol. It's a little hard to say whether or not you should be on a statin or not be on one, but I would assume that the decision to put you on one initially was based on levels being higher than were ideal. And so I would talk to him or her about that and to see whether there's not some other type you can try, and also to, you know, obviously to continue with your regular checkups and blood work.
Okay.
Yes, but I also have heard that there are some statins that are lipophilic and some statins that are hydrophilic, and the ones that are hydrophilic seem to have less side effects.
Well, it varies from patient to patient, and that's really a discussion. I am not a pharmacologist, and so I'm not going to be able to really intelligently discuss with you the various pharmacokinetics of the different types of drugs, and which cause more problems and which do not, and whether or not you're more likely to have a problem with one type or another. That's a discussion really best held with your primary care physician.
Okay, Goldie, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
1-800-348-2551. We've got some more time, and we'll be back with more of your calls right after this on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care, and the Center for Robotic Surgery, sfhospital.org. Spectrum 8 Theaters, Albany, showing Hollywood, American, independent, and foreign films. Their Ultraviolet Cafe is next door for before and after the show. Open daily, spectrum8.com. Storm King Arts Center, a 500-acre sculpture park in the heart of the Hudson Valley, open Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., and until 8 p.m. Saturdays. Now presenting Light and Landscape, stormking.org. WMHT Production Services, providing high-definition video production on location, post-production editing and graphics, as well as full DVD duplication services, WMHT.org. And Hawthorne Valley Farm Store, Harlemville, New York. On a 400-acre farm featuring local, organic, and farm-fresh foods, open Wednesdays and Saturdays, 7:30 to 7, Sundays, 9 to 5, HawthorneValleyFarm.org.
And we are back on Vox Pop. Good afternoon. I'm Bob Barrett in for Alan Shartok on Medical Monday. We're talking heart today. Our guest is Dr. Lewis Britton, head of cardiac surgery at Albany Medical Center. A full board of calls, so let's get right to them. Anne is in Colony. Anne, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you about St. Jude's valve. I had an aortic valve replaced with a St. Jude's valve in August of 2003. Because the bovine valve wouldn't fit the way my arteries came out of the heart. The surgeon told me that he'd never operated on anything like it. He'd only seen it in books, but thank God he was able to save me. I'm wondering, now that I'm in my almost 88th year, and I have outlived almost all my relatives so far, what are the chances of the St. Jude's valve becoming clogged or in trouble, even though I am still on the warfarin that I've taken ever since?
Well, I'm happy to hear that you're doing well, and congratulations on reaching the age of 88 in what sounds like reasonably good health. I think that you've obviously done well for over 9 years with this valve and with the blood thinner regimen that you've been on. There is a small constant risk of either thromboembolic problems, that is clots forming, or hemorrhagic problems, that is bleeding issues, that goes with taking blood thinners such as Coumadin and go along with having mechanical heart valves in. And so that hazard never goes away, or that risk never goes away. And so
my INR has always been within the prescribed limits.
And that's great.
It's never gone too high.
Right. And that puts you in a very small, that puts you in the lowest possible risk category for having any problems. And I would say you've done very well thus far. You obviously are paying very close attention to the blood thinner regime, and your doctor is helping you do that. And you're obviously doing quite well, and I would have no reason to believe you wouldn't continue to do so.
Sounds like you're doing everything right, Ann.
I'm also taking lisinopril because I was borderline high blood pressure, not high.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not a bad thing either. So that will keep your blood pressure under control and hopefully keep you from developing any other problems that can go along with high blood pressure or hypertension as well.
I like it when we have good news for callers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Ann.
Thank you very much.
1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Kimberly in Albany. Kimberly, good afternoon. Hello, Kimberly.
Good afternoon, doctor.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hello, doctor?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I'm 50 years old. 8 years ago, I was diagnosed with a pulmonary embolism, and they attributed it to a protein S deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And then 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with an ascending aortic aneurysm.
Mm-hmm.
And they took me off the Coumadin. So I was kind of wondering, what's your impression about being off the Coumadin, having a secondary diagnosis?
They took you off the Coumadin for what reason?
They didn't really give me a reason.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
It didn't really give me a reason.
Yeah, I would be surprised if the reason for taking you off the Coumadin was because of your aneurysm. How large is the aneurysm?
It's 4.3.
Okay. And as if you were listening earlier, we were talking with another gentleman who'd called in about having an aorta that was 4.1, 4.0. At 4.3, again, without any other conditions that would make you more prone to having problems with weakening of the aorta, there really aren't any things other than limiting your level of isometric type exercise and being on a beta blocker if you can tolerate it that we would do to treat that. And I certainly wouldn't think that for that reason you would come off the Coumadin. Now, I am not a hematologist, and I'm really not qualified to speak at any great length about protein S deficiencies and that type of thing. And in terms of whether or not there was some testing they did that showed that you no longer needed to be on an anticoagulant. Certainly, you know, without knowing all of the details about when your pulmonary embolus occurred and where they thought it originated from and whatnot, it's really hard to say exactly why the Coumadin was stopped, and I think it would be best for you to talk to your physician or whomever did that in the first place to get a little better explanation as to why that was discontinued.
Okay, Kimberly.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. 1-800-348-2551. Have a couple of open lines now, so get your calls in. Let's go to Brian in Shepherd Falls. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for your show. I appreciate both of you. And it's been quite informative. And the question I have is along the lines of education. I have a 91-year-old mom who was diagnosed too late to have any surgery with two heart valves that have now reached severe, one severe and one moderately impaired. And I was wondering if the doctor could discuss how that relates to congestive heart failure, breathing difficulties, and, you know, she's on the appropriate diuretic and other medications, but at 91, things start failing. and she's getting close to where there's nothing else that can be done, and having difficulty breathing or what have you. So I'm just wondering what the process is like when you've done everything you can do medically, and the person is left with the heart valve, which, if you're not going to get hit by a truck, is probably the way that you're going to stop living on this side of the earth. So if you could answer that for me in a general or specific way, I would really appreciate that.
Sure. Can I ask a couple of questions beforehand?
Sure.
Now, you mentioned she has two heart valve problems. Can you give me a little more information on that?
Well, I don't know which I did know, but I can't remember now because it was so long ago that she had those, which heart valve it is. But on the last cardiology appointment we had in Utica, they said one's severe and one's impaired and one's moderately impaired.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's important because we do have some things that have come along relatively recently, particularly in someone in your mother's age group, where we sometimes can help people surgically that we could not in the past. And I'd kind of like to spend a couple minutes on that, if you don't mind, and then we can talk a little bit more about, the gist of your question.
I'll stay on the phone, and I'd love you to do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, if aortic stenosis is her primary problem, if that's the valve that is most severely involved, and it's the main valve letting blood out of the heart, not doing that because it doesn't open well, we do have, in some cases, a procedure now that we can do in people who were previously felt not to be able to be operated upon, whether it be because of age, because of their frailty, their inability to participate in rehabilitation after an operation, or if they have other problems with their lungs or their kidneys that make the risk of an operation too high. And this is what we call a TAVI or TAVR procedure, which is short for a transarterial valve replacement. And in some cases, this is a procedure where people who were previously deemed inoperable can have a procedure where a valve is put in with a catheter to open up that area. And then to get to kind of what the bottom line of your question was, is that the reason people develop heart failure with valve problems, and again, it depends on exactly what the valve problem is, but basically is because it makes the heart work extra hard. And over time, the heart, like any other muscle, it gets a little thicker, it gets a little stronger, and then it gets beyond the point where it can get any stronger or it can get any thicker, or it gets to the point where it's doing so much extra work just to keep the person alive that anything you try to get, you want to do extra, like, you know, go up a flight of stairs or do some exercise or anything like that, you don't have the ability to do that because your heart doesn't have any reserve. And breathing is a very common problem to develop with this, because basically what happens is fluid backs up into the lungs become edematous or swollen, and therefore they don't exchange oxygen as well, and therefore you become short of breath.
Right.
Now, if there is nothing that can be, if we truly, once you get to the end of all of the treatments as far as medical therapy, different medications and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
and there really is no surgical option, if it's not the aortic valve or it's because of leaking valves as opposed to valves that aren't opening well, and if there are a lot of other comorbidities that would prevent any intervention, then unfortunately, it becomes an end-of-life issue, which we deal with on many different levels, and we're still learning, and is a big medical and societal issue at this point in time, which unfortunately I wish I had the answers for, but I do not. I would suggest to you, though, that you might want to talk to your mother's doctors, and we certainly see patients, particularly from the Utica area, but from our entire referral area, who have this type of problem, and to evaluate them to see whether or not they are a potential candidate for this procedure.
Well, Doc, that's incredibly informative. No wonder why you're the head of cardiology. I will thank you for that. And just close with this quick question. Isometrics, you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, I've read an article out of McGill that said that they are actually very supportive to the heart and lowering high blood pressure. Has that been your experience, and do you have any concerns with someone, not someone with a severe heart, not my mother, mm-hmm. but people doing, in general, isometric exercises?
I think that isometric exercises are not in and of themselves bad things. I think they are something, like most things, in moderation. I think, you know, extreme levels of weightlifting and whatnot can be very hard on the heart, in that they do at least bring about brief periods where the blood pressure goes quite high. I think that aerobic exercise in the long run is probably better, but truthfully, a combination of both of those things is really probably the best way to deal with it, because you do want to keep muscle tone and muscle mass, especially as you grow older.
Terrific. Thank you so much, both of you. That's great, and I'm looking forward to hearing your other answers.
All right. Have a great night.
1-800-348-2551.
Let's go to Elaine in Albany. Elaine, good afternoon. Hello, Elaine.
Hello.
That's you. You're on.
I was wondering, what's the lowest acceptable cholesterol level when you're on medication?
I'm not sure that that's been defined, Elaine. I certainly, you know, to a certain extent, we feel lower is better. Certainly, I've known people that had cholesterols in the, you know, the under 150.
Is 96 too low?
Ma'am, I honestly don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
If you're feeling well and you're not having any problems with it, and the different types of cholesterol are in the proper ratio, I would say I wouldn't be too concerned about it. But again, this is something that I would discuss this with your family doctor.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's go to Wyndham, New York, and talk to Ann. Good afternoon, Ann.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, Dr. Britton. Thank you. Dr. Britton, I'm 62 years old, and when I was 50, I was scheduled for a routine thallium stress test, which I did not take, because the day I went to the hospital, there was somebody on the treadmill and died, and they canceled. I had not been injected with the, with the radioactive medication, and we were all told to go home. On the way home, we were rear-ended on the highway, and I thought that I was fine, but the ambulance that came for the car in front of us took my pressure, and the reading was 220. I'm sorry, I don't remember the other number, and they brought me to a major teaching hospital in New York City, Lincoln Hospital, where I was told that I had had a heart attack, and they kept me there for about 5 hours, and they tested my heart twice, and told me, yes, indeed, I had had a heart attack, and then when they released me, they told me to follow up with a cardiologist. When I went to my cardiologist, she told me that it appeared that I had a heart attack, but I actually didn't. That the reason she said they were getting those readings was because of the placement of my heart in the chest. So I've never understood that, and I'm wondering if you might be able to clarify that.
Well, first of all, let me congratulate you on surviving what sounded like a very, very difficult day.
It was. Thank you. And
that must have been tremendously frightening to have somebody go down on the treadmill just before you were supposed to get on it. And then on top of it, to have the misfortune to be involved in an automobile accident, it's quite a bit of stuff.
I just have to interject.
You should have bought a lottery ticket that day, Doctor.
I just want to interject. We only have about two more minutes.
Okay, so I'm sorry. Well, let me get to the. I suspect that what they were saying, the basis for them telling you you'd had a heart attack in the past, was something on your EKG. And EKGs are very helpful tests, but they are not a gold standard, if you will, for myocardial infarction or heart attack. And there are some things that can change based on a patient's anatomy, their body habitus, their size, their shape, that type of thing, and where the leads are placed. And I suspect that that's what occurred here. And I think as long as you're being seen regularly by a physician and this is being followed, you should be just fine.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Britton, and only good things for you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank
All
you so
right.
much, Ann. Let me see. Let's quickly take one more call. Well, I'm not going to take that call because she's gone. Let's go to this one. Melissa, you're the last one up.
Hi, just a quick question. Doctor, is it true that
statins are better to be taken in the evening. I've been told sometimes that I guess it's easier on your kidneys or your liver, and you're supposed to take them in the evening as opposed to in the morning.
You know, that's a question that I asked my own doctor about relatively recently, because it was traditionally with the earlier generation statins that it was better to take them in the evening. And I am told that it really doesn't make that much difference at this point in time. I think it's whenever it's that you're more likely to take them on a regular basis, and, you know, that fits into your daily routine the best.
Okay, yep. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Thanks, Melissa. And that's going to do it for us now, Doctor. Thanks so much for coming in. Not a bad rookie outing here.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Lewis Britton, we thank you so much. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 888-525-4767 for appointments. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Laura Dudek for answering the phones today. Patrick Donges is the producer who typed all this up for me. I'm Bob Barrett, and he spelled it right. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned for the news. Then it's time for the Media Project on WAMC.